Oferecimento Cif Limpeza Milagrosa. Remove 100% da sujeira difícil, sem esforço.
Olá, boa noite, muito bem-vindos. Quando ele apareceu, com músicas feitas a partir de samples, pedaços de outras músicas, muitos não reconheciam sua autoria como compositor. 30 anos de carreira depois, ele lança agora um disco que demonstra com a maior clareza e beleza do mundo que sim, trata-se de um senhor compositor. O álbum novo se chama Reprise, porque reprisa sucessos de sua bem-sucedida carreira, agora arranjados para execução sinfônica pela Orquestra de Arte de Budapeste. É surpreendente ouvi-lo e ser envolvido pelas harmonias de peças que nós só conhecíamos da pulsação rítmica nas pistas. Ele já tinha entrado para a história como autor do álbum de música eletrônica mais vendido de todos os tempos, o Play, de 1999. Vendeu 12 milhões de cópias. Antes disso, já tinha feito muito sucesso tocando techno e também house em clubes, raves, às vezes gravando discos punk cheios de guitarras, às vezes fazendo música ambient para relaxar, trabalhando com nomes que iam de Michael Jackson ao Metallica. Ele se tornou um superastro e aí, da altura das estrelas, despencou na depressão e no vazio que a fama pode trazer. Nos últimos 5 anos, aos 54, parece ter se dedicado a dar sentido ao passado. Escreveu 2 livros de memórias. Também é cada vez mais engajado no ativismo pelos direitos de outros animais. Com o novo trabalho, ele nos traz seu melhor. Grande música, agora despida de eletrônica, em que alarga as franjas de sua criação e sua contribuição para a arte universal. O nosso convidado de hoje é o produtor, cantor, compositor, DJ e multi-instrumentista Moby.
Hi, how are you?
We're so glad to have you with us tonight, Moby. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm having a great time listening to the few tracks that are available of the new album. How did the pandemic, social isolation and it all, interfere or shape the album Reprise?
Well, in some ways, I got really lucky because all of the complicated stuff was done right before the pandemic. One of the last things we did before the pandemic was record an orchestra in Hungary, 130 people. And I think we finished that at the end of February last year.
Wow.
And then one of the only challenging things during the pandemic in terms of making the record was recording a gospel choir. Because as you can imagine, taking 12 singers and putting them in a room, having them stand right next to each other and sing at the top of their lungs, that's not something you should be doing during a pandemic. And so what I did instead was I put a microphone outside of my studio and each singer came over separately and sang their part. And then in the computer, I almost built a gospel choir. But at times, if you listen closely, you can even hear birds singing because they did all their singing outside.
Great, with the birds' free participation. That's very simpatico. Listen, Moby, with the famous yellow Retango Deutsche Grammophon on the cover, it's incredible. And it seems like you've drawn a full circle, finally reconciling or meeting again the young boy that had classical guitar lessons when you were 9. Is that so?
In a way, it is. You're absolutely right. Because when I was 9 years old, I studied music theory. I played jazz. I played classical music. And then when I was around 13, I had this, I'll call it my punk rock awakening. And I was listening to the radio in Connecticut, where I grew up, and I heard The Clash for the first time. And in that instant, I realized I wanted to play in a punk rock band. I didn't want to be a classical guitarist. I didn't want to be a jazz guitarist. Of course, doing that, I broke my music teacher's heart because he wanted me to be this Andres Segovia-style virtuoso musician. But then full circle, as you mentioned, decades later, working on this album, I realized that a lot of what I had learned about music theory and classical music was still lodged in my brain from what I had learned when I was 9, 10, 11 years old.
Even if it's in an unconscious way, it remains there. It was something that made your difference, perhaps. Usually people oppose classical music to popular music. If there is a gap between classical and popular, what is the bridge?
Well, I think the bridge, and it's a wonderful question, I think the bridge is the listener. And what I mean by that is, for the longest time, how music was made directly affected how it was heard. You know, an example being, if this was 100 years ago, being in a symphony space with an orchestra would be a lot different than listening to a blues guitarist play one, you know, sing and play one guitar. But now, the way in which we all hear music is through two speakers. And in a way, it's still fascinating how music is created, but the ultimate test, the ultimate criteria by which music is judged is how we respond to it emotionally. The bridge between, I think, all types of music is that subjective emotional reaction.
Some scholars and some musicians, they say that the difference between beautiful and sublime is that sublime is beautiful with a little flaw, something that shouldn't or didn't have to be there. Is that so? Is that true for you?
You're absolutely right. That is such a wonderful concept. I'm glad that you brought that up. Like in Japanese, it's called wabi-sabi. You know, the idea that the imperfection is oftentimes what gives us emotional access to something. And yeah, so I completely agree. So when I say that I was working with classical musicians who were being perfect, they're still human. And, you know, the same thing with the vocalists, with the gospel choir, is even if they're almost perfect at what they do, there's always that humanity to them. And I think that's where the emotion resides. And I'm not being so presumptuous.
No, I mean,
what I do is sublime, but at least like preserving that humanity and letting the humanity communicate emotion is such an important aspect of it.
You can find that in Mozart, some notes that are there that you don't, why are they there? Or in Rolling Stones or, but anyway, that reminds me of something you said that was very touching for me, was inspiring. You mentioned the beauty of a certain vulnerability you find in acoustic and classical music. Could you elaborate on this idea of the vulnerability of art and artists?
Well, yes, it's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, because we live in a culture where people really don't like vulnerability. You know, I mean, you think of like politicians and pop stars and athletes, like everyone's trying to seem like a superhero. Like, you know, if you look on social media, everyone's trying to look perfect and to look young or to be strong or whatever. And I actually think that the shadow self is vulnerability. You know, it's awkwardness. It's what connects us, you know, like, as I don't know about you, but my friendships, my relationships, you know, my spiritual life, my creative life, it's the vulnerability that I'm most attracted to. I've tried working with quote unquote perfect singers, and it's kind of boring. Whereas when you work with the vocalists who can communicate strength and vulnerability in equal measure, that's where things potentially become human and beautiful and profound. Early on, I didn't want to be a vulnerable musician. I didn't want to be a vulnerable performer. I wanted to be perfect. I wanted to walk on stage and feel like a superhero and be sexy and strong and powerful. But I am not very tall and I'm bald. And That's who I am. So if I walk on stage, I'm like fully aware of the fact that I'm a middle-aged guy who's bald, who's got a, you know, gray hair. My posture isn't that great. Like, there's almost a strength, I think, in accepting who we are rather than being driven insane or being made miserable by who we aren't, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. Let me tell the news to the Brazilian audience. There's also a release of a Moby Doc, the documentary that tells the story of Moby in a peculiar way, let's say, a surreal way. Sounds very attractive. Did you leave the director free to produce his own version of your life, or did you take part in script or editing of the final thing?
It was very much a creative collaboration between the director and I. And when we started working on this movie, on Moby Doc, we gave ourselves two goals. One, try to be honest. And two, to make a music documentary that's unlike any music documentary we'd ever seen. So there's so much, there's a lot of surrealism. There's a lot of devices and narrative tools that we'd never seen in a movie before. So we gave ourselves a lot of creative freedom to just do what seemed interesting or emotional to us.
Let me show you some Brazilian memories of Moby. 1993, your first trip to Brazil.
That was, it's amazing to me how old I am.
because there you were, what, 25 you were there? 1993?
I was maybe 20, like basically I wasn't 30 yet. And the rave scene, it was the height of the rave scene. And of course, I look at that and my first completely self-involved thought is that I used to have hair. Like, I'm so used to being an old bald guy, I'd sort of forgotten that there was ever a time in my life when I had hair. And so when you first played that, I almost didn't recognize myself because I'm just used to looking in the mirror and seeing like old bald guy, not like young, cute guy with hair.
Actually, we had lots of hair.
It's just not where I want it.
Listen, a very important character in your memories is your New York neighbor, David Bowie. You became friends, companions. You say Bowie is the greatest musician of all times. But Bowie, I have the privilege of having an interview with him in 1992 or three, around this time, you were here in Brazil, in London. And he told me that music was a pretext. It was the medium he chose and used to express his art. How do you relate to that? Do you think you could express yourself despite of music?
Well, it's a wonderful idea. I am tempted to ramble on for a really long time about it because I'm a loudmouth and I like to ramble on, but I also don't want to bore you and your audience. What I will say is about 20 years ago, I started working with this organization in New York, started by Oliver Sacks, who was a neuroscientist, and it's called the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. And it looked at music and how it actually affects the brain, how it promotes neurogenesis and helps heal the hippocampus and decrease stress hormones. And it made me think very differently about music and really how phenomenally, powerfully spiritual music can be. And if we think about it, like, music is played at funerals, it's played at weddings, it's played at christenings, it's played in stadiums where 100,000 people jump up and down. But all that music is air molecules moving a little bit differently. And so fascinating that by moving air a little bit differently, we can make people cry, we can make people dance. And so I understand what David's saying, because David was, in English, the word is a polymath, you know, someone who does a lot of different types of creative disciplines. But I see music as being this phenomenal spiritual form of communication that in my mind, and I, this might be a strange thing to say, but it's almost separate from other types of creative expression. If we think about it, I will read my favorite books 3 or 4 times in my life. I will watch my favorite movies 5 or 10 times in my life. I will listen to my favorite pieces of music thousands of times. And every time I listen to Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, it's so powerful. Every time I listen to Vincent by Don McLean, it's so powerful. And that's so remarkable that even the 1,000th time of hearing Imagine by John Lennon, it still affects me emotionally.
Almost Home, a piece of your music, is a big hit in Brazil because it became the soundtrack of a soap opera. In Brazil, soap operas are one of the main cultural features. How does it feel to see your music acquiring different meanings when it's used like this? Scenes and novellas.
On one hand, it's so flattering because, there's so many, quite literally billions of pieces of music in the world. So for anyone to listen to my music or to use my music for a movie or a TV show, it's very flattering. Of course, watching that footage as an old guy who doesn't really date anymore, I was a little bit jealous. I was like, wow, people still do that. I had sort of forgotten that anybody still has a sex life.
It's like riding a bike. You won't forget it.
I don't know. Suffice it to say, it's been a long time since I've ridden a bike. But the other thing that reminded me of is the fascinating democratic chaos of the world in which we live, that, a song can be written at 3 o'clock in the morning here in Los Angeles. I can send it to the singer, Damien Jurado, who lives in Seattle, send it to him, and then it goes out into the world and people use it in the most interesting ways.
It's amazing. Listen, the club scene will be the last to return to some kind of normality after the pandemic. How do you guess the social trauma of the plague will be reflected by music and art in general?
Wow, what an interest. Because I know a lot of people are talking about the Spanish flu of 100 years ago and how some cultural theorists believe that the jazz age of the 20s was the product of the Spanish flu because they had a few years of being locked down. And when they came out of lockdown, everyone wanted to go out and dance and have romance. And I wonder, it seems like that's going to happen again. Although to be clear, it's not going to happen to me. I stay home and read books and watch TV and work on music. Like once the pandemic is done, I'll probably still just stay home and read books and make music.
Listen, in your memories and in Moby Dog, Doc, the drugs issue is very recurrent. The German writer, Norman Ohler, he wrote a book about the drugs and the Nazis. High Hitler is his book. He has shown the importance that MDMA had in the reconciliation, in the reunification of Germany, reconciliation between East and West youth. So we know the harm drugs do, alcohol do, but what was the positive side, the importance of MDMA in the late 20th century art?
Well, that's the thing. I'm an alcoholic and I'm a drug addict, so I have to be sober. Personally, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with most alcohol and drugs. These are, they're chemicals, they're molecules. And a lot of people, in fact, the majority of people can drink and be recreational very, as we know, in very healthy ways. So I don't criticize what other people do. I don't criticize even the molecules behind alcohol and drugs. I just know I can't do them. And you're right. MDMA was for years a therapeutic drug. It was administered in therapeutic sessions and it was a huge part of like couples counseling, a lot of, as you mentioned, like reconciliations, especially in other countries. And one thing I do find very encouraging, I don't know if this is happening in Brazil, but in the United States, we're slowly moving past the stigma around therapeutic drugs. Like there's some, you know, like psychedelic drugs like ketamine, MDMA, that have amazing therapeutic benefits for people with anxiety and depression, but they were banned by the government for a long time, and they're slowly being allowed to be used in therapeutic settings. So I find that to be potentially really encouraging.
Yeah, it's called the psychedelic renaissance, with the psilocybin as well. Well, it has to be administered by professionals, by doctors and physicians, and it could be very helpful. When you came to Brazil in 2005, you came with your band. It was the peak of your success, and you described this period as the worst of your life. Depression, panic, anxiety, alcoholism. Why is emptiness, spiritual void, suffering so common after fame?
It's a great question. And I think from my perspective, when I was growing up, and I think this is true for a lot of people, I just had the assumption that if I ever had financial success, if I ever had creative and career success, that immediately happiness would follow. And for a minute, it does. Like when you first find yourself famous or financially successful, there's that moment of excitement where everything seems great. But ultimately, and I know maybe I'm stating the obvious, but ultimately fame, success, et cetera, it doesn't fix the underlying issues. It doesn't fix who we are psychologically. It doesn't heal the pain from the past, which is why so many people, when they become famous, they ultimately become addicts and even hurt themselves. You know, I think of Robin Williams, Avicii, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, Anthony Bourdain. The list is endless of people who were ultimately sort of destroyed by fame. And I tried. I mean, like I had a period where I was, you know, this bottomed out alcoholic, drug addict, and I wanted to kill myself and I was miserable. I'm just lucky that I was able to get through that and get to the, you know, the place where I am now. It's like, as mentioned, I'm old and I'm bald, but I'm sober and I'm pretty happy.
We're very happy that you didn't succeed in self-destruction. Listen, Brazil's greatest writer, the 19th century author Machado de Assis, he wrote, "The first man that had the idea of creating a society for animals' protection has done a great deed in favor of humankind." What kind of deeds do humankind and other animals need right now in the 21st century?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's pretty clear from my tattoos that animal rights is important to me. And so I became a vegan 34 years ago. And at first, the reason I became an animal rights activist was my love for animals and my simple belief that I don't want to be a part of anything that causes animal suffering or contributes to animal suffering. But having said that, there's a whole other aspect to the issue of animals, which is how animal agriculture is destroying us, you know, from pandemics, as we know, deforestation, climate change, antibiotic resistance, water use, et cetera, you know, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, obesity, all these consequences of using animals for food. So in a way, like I'm an animal rights activist for the animals, but what you were, the quote that you referenced, I almost feel like you could make a very compelling argument for being a committed animal rights activist to save humans, you know, because there's almost no other industry on the planet that's destroying us as much as our reliance on animal agriculture.
Each of us has to do his part, and you're doing your part, Moby. Thank you so much for your time. It was really a wonderful conversation, and all the best for a reprise for the Moby Doc. and we really appreciated this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, this was wonderful. I almost feel like I owe you a great debt because this was like a wonderful therapy session.
No, that's good. Give me a call anytime.
Okay.
All the best.
Okay, Take care. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you. Até a próxima.
Ficou curioso para ver as imagens do programa? É só entrar na página do Conversa no Globoplay. Tá tudo lá. Até a próxima.